Well, the party is off to a good start. Guests are on time. Everyone's out to have fun and to help others fun.
What's the matter? Doesn't that sound exciting to you?
UBC students have an alternative. Looking to unwind? Check out one of the sub's two licensed establishments.
The Pit Pub and Burger Bar is home of the famous Pit Night. Relax with great prices on cold beer and lots of big screen HD TVs, or chow down on charbroiled burgers, beer battered fish and chips, and Belgian fries. The Pit is open 7 days a week, and Wednesday through Saturday is open late until 2 a.m. This business is owned and operated by the AMS, your student society.
Now.
Yo, Bleak! Yo, Bleak! You coming out to play?
What's the time on this?
Oh, man.
I know, man.
Yo, Bleak!
Anyway,
we got to have a game!
Coming out!
Go outside!
Boys!
Bleak, Bleak, we need you!
Please, be quiet!
Sorry, Mrs. Gilliam. We just want to know if Bleak can come out.
I understand that. But this noise has got to stop.
All Bleak cares about is Bleak.
Is that so?
Oh, so that is. Can you just take a look around?
Bleak brought this from me a year ago, man. This is a rare out-of-print bird.
Look, I'm a delivery man making deliveries. Any static, taking it with Bleak.
Bleak, 2 E's, 1 K. Right now, I'd like to bring to the stage a fine musician. As well, a very dear friend. Please give a warm welcome to Mr. Bleak.
Good evening, everybody. It is Exquisite Corpse Radio on CITR 101.9 Vancouver. This is Bleak here with you this evening. And it is the 29th of October, which means in 2 days we get the creepy ghoulies, the monsters come out, and then the kids come to your door. And either give you a trick or a treat, or is it the other way around? The other way around. But just the other day, somebody was telling me that what they did was bought the candy for the kids, then basically shut all the lights off at the last minute. I guess decided what they really wanted to do was just sit alone in the darkness, eating all the candy themselves. So I hope you're not doing that tonight. Be good to the kiddies. Anyway, tonight I have got for you a special Bleak / the Value Village People Halloween mix that I've just created for you for this event tonight. So enjoy. I'm not going to be saying much tonight, so we can just go right through with all of it. And there'll be a lot of creepy stuff you may recognize and some you may not, but enjoy. Hope you enjoy the podcast as well. CITR.ca.
They say that when it comes, you hear the bell ringing dismally, frightfully. I wonder if the bell will ring tonight. Just a second.
Serpents and spiders, tale of a rat. Call in the spirits wherever they're at. Rap on a table. It's time to respond. Send us a message from somewhere beyond. Goblins and ghoulies from last Halloween. Awaken the spirits with your tambourine. Creepies and crawlies, toads in a pond. Let there be music from regions beyond. Wizards and witches, wherever you dwell, give us a hint by ringing a bell.
Thank you.
blood.
This chamber has no windows and no doors.
What do you mean?
Feel better now?
Oh, I think I do feel a little better.
You think I'm mad, all of you?
Welcome, foolish mortals, to the Haunted Mansion.
Shall I tell you what it was like? It was a darkness shaping itself forth from the air in very undefined outline. I cannot say it was a human form, and yet it had more resemblance to a human form than anything else. As it stood, its dimensions seemed gigantic, the summit nearly reaching the ceiling. As I stared, I thought that I distinguished two eyes looking down on me from the boiling air. I tried to speak, but could not. I could only think to myself, is this fear? Is this fear? I tried to move, but could not. I felt as if I were weighted down by an irresistible force. Opposed to my will was another, far superior. My fear now became horror. Horror that no words can convey. Still, I retained pride. And if not pride, then courage. For in my mind I said, this is horror, but it is not fear. Unless I fear, I cannot be harmed. With a great deal of effort, I reached my hand out toward the dagger on the table. But as I did, I felt a strange shock on my arm and shoulder, and I was powerless. And now the light slowly began to wane from the candles. The same was happening with the fire. In a moment, the room was in utter darkness, and my terror reached a climax. And wonder of wonders, I broke forth with the words, I do not fear. My soul does not fear. With that, I found the strength to leap from the bed and rush to the window and throw back the curtains and fling open the shutters, for my first thought was, light!
The great day of his wrath has come. Dust, and who will be able to stand? Thus I saw the horse in a vision. Out of his mouth issued fire and brimstone. And I beheld and heard an angel singing. For the great day of his wrath has come. Give them the morning star.
Host's workmen routed up the birds with long poles and drove them towards the waiting guns, made him feel himself a parody on the ancestors who had roamed the moors and forests of this West Riding of Yorkshire in hot pursuit of game worth the killing. But when in England in August, he always accepted whatever proffered for the season and invited his host to shoot pheasants on his estates in the south. The amusements of life, he argued, should be accepted with the same philosophy as its ills. It had been a bad day. A heavy rain had made the moor so spongy that it fairly sprang beneath the feet. Whether or not the grouse had haunts of their own, wherein they were immune from rheumatism, the bag had been small. The women, too, were an unusually dull lot, with the exception of a new-minded debutante who bothered Weigel at dinner by demanding the verbal restoration of the vague paintings on the vaulted roof above them. But it was no one of these things that sat on Weigel's mind as, when the other men went up to bed, he let himself out of the castle and sauntered down to the river. His intimate friend, the companion of his boyhood, the chum of his college days, his fellow traveller in many lands, the man for whom he possessed stronger affection than for all men, had mysteriously disappeared 2 days ago, and his track might have sprung to the upper air for all trace he had left behind him. He had been a guest on the adjoining estate during the past week, shooting with the fervor of the true sportsman, making love in the intervals to Adeline Cavan, and apparently in the best of spirits. As far as was known, there was nothing to lower his mental mercury, for his rent roll was a large one. Miss Cavan blushed whenever he looked at her, and, being one of the best shots in England, he was never happier than in August. The suicide theory was preposterous, all agreed, and there was as little reason to believe him murdered. Nevertheless, he had walked out of March Abbey 2 nights ago without hat or overcoat and had not been seen since. The country was being patrolled night and day. 100 keepers and working men were beating the woods and poking the bogs on the moors, but as yet not so much as a handkerchief had been found. Weigel did not believe for a moment that Wyatt Gifford was dead, and although it was impossible not to be affected by the general uneasiness, he was disposed to be more angry than frightened. At Cambridge, Gifford had been an incorrigible practical joker, and by no means had outgrown the habit. It would be like him to cut across the country in his evening clothes, board a cattle train, and amuse himself touching up the picture of the sensation in West Riding. However, Weigel's affection for his friend was too deep to companion with tranquility in the present state of doubt. And instead of going to bed early with the other men, he determined to walk until ready for sleep. He went down to the river and followed the path through the woods. There was no moon, but the stars sprinkled their cold light upon the pretty belt of water flowing placidly past wood and ruin, between green masses of overhanging rocks or sloping banks tangled with tree and shrub, leaping occasionally over stones with the harsh notes of an angry scold, to recover its equanimity the moment the way was clear again. It was very dark in the depths where Weigel trod. He smiled as he recalled a remark of Gifford's. An English wood is like a good many other things in life, very promising at a distance, but a hollow mockery when you get within. You see daylight on both sides, and the sun freckles the very bracken. Our woods need the night to make them seem what they ought to be, what they once were, before our ancestors' descendants demanded so much more money in these so much more various days. Weigel strolled along, smoking and thinking of his friend, his pranks, many of which had done more credit to his imagination than this, and recalling conversations that had lasted the night through. Just before the end of the London season, they had walked the streets one hot night after a party, discussing the various theories of the soul's destiny. That afternoon, they had met at the coffin of a college friend whose mind had been a blank for the past 3 years. Some months previously, they had called at the asylum to see him. His expression had been senile, his face imprinted with the record of debauchery. In death, the face was placid, intelligent, without ignoble lineation, the face of the man they had known at college. Weigel and Gifford had had no time to comment there, and the afternoon and evening were full, but coming forth from the house of festivity together, they had reverted almost at once to the topic. I cherish the theory, Gifford had said, that the soul sometimes lingers in the body after death. During madness, of course, it is an impotent prisoner, albeit a conscious one. Fancy its agony and its horror. What more natural than that when the life spark goes out, the tortured soul should take possession of the vacant skull and triumph once more for a few hours while old friends look their last. It has had time to repent while compelled to crouch and behold the result of its work, and has shrived itself into a state of comparative purity. If I had my way, I should stay inside my bones until the coffin had gone into its niche, that I might obviate for my poor old comrade the tragic impersonality of death. And I should like to see justice done to it, as it were, to see it lowered among its ancestors with the ceremony and solemnity that are its due. I'm afraid that if I dissevered myself too quickly, I should yield to curiosity and hasten to investigate the mysteries of space. You believe in the soul as an independent entity, then? That it and the vital principle are not one and the same? Absolutely. The body and soul are twins, life comrades, sometimes friends, sometimes enemies, but always loyal in the last instance. Someday, when I am tired of the world, I shall go to India and become a Mahatma, solely for the pleasure of receiving proof during life of this independent relationship. Suppose you were not sealed up properly and returned after one of your astral flights to find your earthly part unfit for habitation. It is an experiment I don't think I should care to try, unless even juggling with soul and flesh had palled. That would not be an uninteresting predicament. I should rather enjoy experimenting with broken machinery. The high, wild roar of water smote suddenly on Weigel's ear and checked his memories. He left the wood and walked out on the huge, slippery stones which nearly closed the river wharf at this point and watched the waters boil down into the narrow pass with their furious, untiring energy. The black quiet of the woods rose high on either side. The stars seemed colder and whiter just above. On either hand, the perspective of the river might have run into a rayless cavern. There was no lonelier spot in England, nor one which had the right to claim so many ghosts, if ghosts there were. Weigel was not a coward, but he recalled uncomfortably the tales of those that had been done to death in the Strid. Wordsworth's Boy of Egremont had been disposed of by the practical Whittaker, but countless others, more venturesome than wise, had gone down into that narrow, boiling course, never to appear in the still pool a few yards beyond. Below the great rocks which form the walls of the Strid was believed to be a natural vault, onto whose shelves the dead were drawn. The spot had an ugly fascination. Weigel stood, visioning skeletons, uncoffined and green, the home of the eyeless things which had devoured all that had covered and filled that rattling symbol of man's mortality, then fell to wondering if anyone had attempted to leap the Strid of late. It was covered with slime. He had never seen it look so treacherous. He shuddered and turned away, impelled, despite his manhood, to flee the spot. As he did so, something tossing in the foam below the fall, something as white, yet independent of it, caught his eye and arrested his step. Then he saw that it was describing a contrary motion to the rushing water, an upward, backward motion. Weigel stood rigid, breathless. He fancied he heard the crackling of his hair. Was that a hand? It thrust itself still higher above the boiling foam, turned sideways, and four frantic fingers were distinctly visible against the black rock beyond. Weigel's superstitious terror left him. A man was there, struggling to free himself from the suction beneath the Strid, swept down, doubtless, but a moment before his arrival, perhaps as he stood with his back to the current. He stepped as close to the edge as he dared. The hand doubled as if in imprecation, shaking savagely in the face of that force which leaves its creatures to immutable law, then spread wide again, clutching, expanding, crying for help as audibly as the human voice. Weigel dashed to the nearest tree, dragged and twisted off a branch with his strong arms, and returned as swiftly to the Strid. The hand was in the same place, still gesticulating as wildly. The body was undoubtedly caught in the rocks below, perhaps already halfway along one of those hideous shelves. Weigel let himself down upon a lower rock, braced his shoulder against the mass behind him, then leaning out over the water, thrust the branch into the hand. The fingers clutched it convulsively. Weigel tugged powerfully. His own feet dragged perilously near the edge. For a moment, he produced no impression. Then an arm shot above the waters. The blood sprang to Weigel's head. He was choked with the impression that the Strid had him in her roaring hold, and he saw nothing. Then the mist cleared. The hand and arm were nearer, although the rest of the body was still concealed by the foam. Weigel peered out with distended eyes. The meager light revealed in the cuffs links of a peculiar device. The fingers clutching the branch were as familiar. Weigel forgot the slippery stones, the terrible death if he stepped too far. He pulled with passionate will and muscle. Memories flung themselves into the hot light of his brain, trooping rapidly upon each other's heels, as in the thought of the drowning. Most of the pleasures of his life, good and bad, were identified in some way with this friend. Scenes of college days, of travel, where they had deliberately sought adventures and stood between one another and death, upon more occasions than one, of hours of delightful companionship among the treasures of art and others in the pursuit of pleasure, flashed like the changing particles of a kaleidoscope. Weigel had loved several women, but he would have flouted in these moments the thought that he had ever loved any woman as he loved Wyatt Gifford. There were so many charming women in the world, but in the 32 years of his life, he had never known another man to whom he had cared to give his intimate friendship. He threw himself on his face. His wrists were cracking. The skin was torn from his hands. The fingers still gripped the stick. There was life in them yet. Suddenly, something gave way. The hand swung about, tearing the branch from Weigel's grasp. The body had been liberated and flung outward, though still submerged by the foam and spray. Weigel scrambled to his feet and sprang along the rocks, knowing that the danger from suction was over and that Gifford must be carried straight to the quiet pool. Gifford was a fish in the water and could live under it longer than most men. If he survived this, it would not be the first time that his pluck and science had saved him from drowning. Weigel reached the pool. A man in his evening clothes floated on it. His face turned towards a projecting rock over which his arm had fallen, upholding the body. The hand that had held the branch hung limply over the rock, its white reflection visible in the black water. Weigel plunged into the shallow pool, lifted Gifford in his arms, and returned to the bank. He laid the body down and threw off his coat that he might be the freer to practice the methods of resuscitation. He was glad of the moment's respite. The valiant life in the man might have been exhausted in that last struggle. He had not dared to look at his face, to put his ear to the heart. The hesitation lasted but a moment. There was no time to lose. He turned to his prostrate friend. As he did so, something strange and disagreeable smote his senses. For a half moment, he did not appreciate its nature. And he sprang to the side of the man and bent down and peered into his face. There was no face.
What is it you want? In your depths of your ignorance, what is it you want?
Hey, this is Mark Hosler of Negative Land, and this is my big shot at being a big shot on CITR, where you're listening to Exquisite Corpse at 101.9.
What am I doing this one?
With this bleak guy.
Come on, fellas, you're losing your heads.
Mr. Nuttall was a very nervous man. He had been undergoing treatment for several years now, and as he had an independent income and no need to work, he spent a great deal of his time in visits to friends and relatives. Before his nervous condition had come about, he had been an almost total recluse, spending a great deal of time raising mushrooms in his damp cellar and reading a large number of books. As a consequence, his visits to see relations consisted of meeting a large group of comparative strangers. It was in the early fall of the year when he knocked on the door of the Sappleton residence. He was ushered in by a very dignified 10-year-old girl who asked him to have a seat and told him that her aunt would be down shortly. She sat for a moment, glancing at a large, strangely bound book, then looked up at Mr. Nuttall. You know many of the people around here? She asked. Hardly a soul, says Mr. Nuttall. Then you know practically nothing about my aunt, said the girl. Now, Mr. Nuttall admitted he knew only her name and address. The young girl smiled sympathetically. Her great tragedy happened just 3 years ago. Tragedy? Inquired the nervous Mr. Nuttall. The girl pointed to the French window leading to the lawn. You may wonder why we keep that window open in the fall of the year. It is quite warm for this time of the year, said Mr. Nuttall, shifting his chair. But has that window got anything to do with the tragedy? The girl then told him this story. Out through that window 3 years ago this very day, her husband and her two younger brothers went off for a day's hunting in the woods you can see there. They never came back. In crossing the swamps to their favorite piece of hunting ground, all of them were engulfed in a treacherous piece of quicksand. Their bodies were never recovered. That was the dreadful part of it. My poor aunt thinks they will all come back someday. They and the little brown dog that was lost with them. And walk in that window just as they used to do. That is why the window is kept open every evening till night falls. Poor dear aunt. She has often told me how they went out. Her husband with his white raincoat over his arm. And Ronnie, her youngest brother, singing, as he always did to tease her because she said it got on her nerves. You know that sometimes on still, quiet evenings like this, I almost get the creepy feeling that they will all walk in through that window. Mr. Nuttall shuddered and was relieved when the aunt bustled into the room with a whirl of apologies for being late and making her appearance. I hope Vera has been amusing you, she said. She's been very interesting, said Mr. Nuttall, glancing in the direction of the open window. The long shadows of the late afternoon made the distant trees even gloomier, he thought. I do hope you don't mind the open window, said the aunt in a brisk voice. My husband and brothers will be home shortly from hunting, and they always come in this way. They've been out in the marshland today, so they'll make a fine mess on my poor carpets. So like you men folks, isn't it? She prattled on cheerfully about the hunting and the scarcity of birds and the prospects for duck in the winter. And Mr. Nuttall, it was all purely horrible. He made a desperate but not too successful attempt to turn the talk to a less ghastly topic, but he was conscious that his hostess was not giving him a great deal of her attention. Her eyes were constantly straying past him to the open window. He thought it was an unfortunate coincidence that he should have paid his visit on this tragic anniversary. He cleared his throat nervously and tried once more to capture the attention of his hostess. The doctors agree in ordering me complete rest, an absence of mental excitement, and the avoidance of anything in the way of physical exercise.
On the matter of diet, they are not so much in agreement. No, said the aunt. Then she suddenly brightened into alert attention. Here they are at last, and just in time for tea. Don't they look as if they're muddy up to the eyes? Mr. Nutter shivered slightly and turned toward the little girl to give her a smile of sympathy. The child was staring out through the open window with dazed horror in her eyes. In the chill shock of nameless fear, Mr. Nutter swung around and looked in the same direction. In the deepening twilight, three figures were walking across the lawn toward the window. They all carried guns under their arms, and one of them carried a muddy white raincoat. A tired brown spaniel was close at their heels. Noiselessly, they neared the house. And then Mr. Nuttall heard... Just as the little girl had said, one of the men was singing. Mr. Nuttall grabbed wildly for his hat and coat and dove for the front door. Flinging it open, he ran down the path, tried to jump the hedges, tripped and fell down. He picked himself up and with one terrified look back at the house, ran down the road toward the railroad station. Back in the house, the figure carrying the muddy white raincoat stepped in the open window and said, "Well, we're home, dear. A bit muddy, but on time for supper. Who was that that ran out as we came up to the house?" "That was a Mr. Nuttall, dear," said the aunt. "Some distant relative who dropped in for a visit. Extraordinary man. All he seemed to talk about was his illness. And when he saw you coming, dashed off without saying a word. I don't know what to make of it." The little girl shook her head gravely and said, "I expect it was the spaniel. Mr. Nuttall has a horror of dogs. He was telling me just before you came down that once he was chased into a cemetery by a pack of wild dogs and had to spend the night in a newly dug grave with the creatures snarling and grinning and foaming just above him." "Oh, why, the poor man," said her aunt. "One would have thought he had seen a ghost." The little girl smiled sweetly.
I feel the motion of the car before I open my eyes. The air is blue black, brown black, black black. Smell of gas, oil, animals. I'm in the trunk. And ankles tied, tape over my mouth. It almost covers my nose, but I can breathe barely. I must have been here for hours. Everything is stiff. My head throbs like someone's drumming on china. The car stops. It turns off the motor, but there are no traffic sounds, no people sounds, no wind. What place has no wind? I turn my head towards the sounds like people watch radios when something terrible happens. My palms are sweating. Where am I? The trunk squeaks as he lifts it up and the sun blinds me. He almost looks like a faceless Jesus surrounded by light. Pulls me out of the trunk and bangs my head against the door. I try to cry out, but it comes like a hum. It drags me half standing along a dirt road into a house. I can't see any other houses and it looks like a farm. The screen door bangs behind me and I feel a deep, deep pressure inside. All the rules have changed here. I'm dragged down a hall like a bag and I look for a phone. Other doors. Nothing but bare floors and brown boxes and small rooms. He pulls me into the bathroom and I almost crack my head as he pushes me onto the floor. He tilts his head to the side and gazes at me as if I was a pet, then walks.
walks out. I'm lying there for a long time trying to get the tape off of me. My eyes are tearing. I don't make a sound. I can't get up and I keep rolling from side to side, trying not to make noise. If I can get him to talk to me, if I can get this thing on my face, I can talk to him. I'll tell him my name. Have you killed other women in here? I'm thinking you've got hundreds of them nailed down, hung on walls, hanging from ceiling fans, swinging dead in summer wind. Why did he pick me? If I'd stayed to finish, the library would have been there 20 minutes longer. Maybe I'd have been okay. I would have rushed into the house, books piled up in my arms like a baby, and blurty explanations why I was sorry. So sorry I'm late, everyone. Would you have waited for me anyway? Would you have picked another woman? Would I read about her in the paper and said, oh my God, I was there that night? Called all my friends in a panic, telling them how much I love them as if I'd never had the chance again. I wonder what everyone is doing now. Putting up signs, showing my picture on the evening news, friends. Maybe I'm not even considered missing yet. My family will fall apart and my parents will go crazy, slowly. My brother will be so quiet at the funeral and insist the casket be closed. I never even told anyone what kind of funeral I wanted when I died. Maybe years from now they'll find my skeleton on the floor here and they'll have to use dental records to identify me. The family will say, at least we know now. We always hope she was alive somewhere. We just hope she's in peace. When I sleep, my dreams are crazy. I'm flying over fields. I don't think I sleep for more than 20 minutes. When I wake up, it feels like I'm under a heavy blanket. I'm still here. As I wake up, I hear a dog barking in the distance, and I think I'm in my parents' house in South Carolina. When I open my eyes, there's a shotgun pressed between them. I'll never get married. I'll never have kids. I'll never go to Europe. I'll never learn to play a piano. I'll never write a book. The last thing I hear is a click.
Quite how I planned our wedding, right?
No, but...
In moments of intense mental strain, the truth sometimes overpowers all one's better resolves. It sounds brutal, horrible. I don't know what I meant to say. What I said was, you can't, she's dead. He sprang up in bed and I caught him by the shoulders. Then it's true, he cried. And I'm not mad. Oh, great God in heaven, let me go to her. Let me go. It's true. It's true. I held him fast and spoke. I am strong. You know that. You are weak and ill. You're quite in my power. We're all friends. There's nothing I wouldn't do to serve you. Tell me what you mean. I will do anything you wish. This I said to soothe him. Let me go to her, he said again. Tell me all about it, I repeated. You're too ill to go to her. I will go, if you could collect yourself and tell me why. You could not walk 5 yards. He looked at me doubtfully. You'll help me? You won't say I'm mad and have me shut up? You'll help me? Yes, yes, I swear it. All the time I was wondering what I should do to keep him from his mad purpose. He lay back on his pillows, white and ghastly. His thin features and sunken eyes showed hawk-like above the rough growth of his 4 weeks' beard. I took his hand. His pulse was rapid, and his lean fingers clenched themselves round mine. Look here, he said. I don't know. There aren't any words to tell you how true it is. I am not mad. I'm not wandering. I'm as sane as you are. Now listen. And if you have a human heart in you, you'll help me. When I married her, I gave up hypnotism and all the old studies. She hated the whole business. But before I gave up, I hypnotized her. And when she was so completely under my control, I forbade her soul to leave its body till my time came to die. I breathed more freely. Now I understood why he had said she cannot die. My dear old man, I said gently, dismiss these fancies and face your grief boldly. You can't control the great facts of life and death by hypnotism. She is dead. She's dead. And her body lies in its place, but her soul is with God who gave it. No, he cried with such strength as the fever had left him. No, no. Ever since I've been ill, I've seen her every day, every night, and always wringing her hands and moaning, let me go, John. Let me go. Those were her last words indeed. I think it is natural that they should haunt you. See, you bade her soul not leave her body. It has left it, for she is dead. His answer came almost in a whisper, born of the wings of a long, breathless pause. She is dead. But her soul has not left her body. I held his hand more closely, still debating what I should do. She comes to me, he went on. She comes to me continually. She does not reproach, but she implores, let me go, John, let me go. And I have no more power now. I cannot let her go. I cannot reach her. I can do nothing, nothing. Oh, he cried with a sudden sharp change of voice to thrill through me to the ends of my fingers and feet. Oh, Kate, my life, I will come to you. No, no. You shouldn't be left alone among the dead. I am coming, my sweet. He reached his arms out towards the door with a look of longing and love, so really, so patently addressed to his sentient presence that I turned sharply to see if, in truth, perhaps, nothing, of course, nothing. She is dead, I repeated stupidly. I was obliged to bury her. A shudder ran through him. I must go and see for myself, he said. Then I knew, all in a minute, what I must do. I will go, I said. I will open her coffin. And if she is not as other dead folk, I will bring her body back to this house. Will you go now? He asked with set lips. It was nigh on midnight. I looked into his eyes. Yes, now, I said. But you must swear to lie still to her return. I swear it. I saw I could trust him, and I went to wake the nurse. He called weakly after me. There's a lantern in the tool shed in Bernard. Yes, my poor old chap. There's a screwdriver in the sideboard drawer. I think until he said that I really meant to go. I'm not accustomed to lie, even to mad people, and I think I meant it till then. He leaned on his elbow and looked at me with wide, open eyes. Think, he said, what she must feel. Out of the body, and yet tied to it, all alone among the dead. Oh, make haste, for if I am not mad, and I've really fettered her soul, there is but one way, and that is, I must die too. Her soul can leave her body when I die. I called the nurse and left him. I went out and across the wall to the church, but I did not go in. I carried the screwdriver and the lantern, lest he should send the nurse to see if I had taken them. I leaned on the churchyard wall and thought of her. I had loved the woman, and I remembered it in that hour. As soon as I dared, I went back to him. Remember, I believed him mad, and told the lie that I thought would give him most ease. Well, he said eagerly as I entered. I signed to the nurse to leave us. There is no hope, I said. You will not see your wife again till you meet her in heaven. I laid down the screwdriver and the lantern, and sat down by him. I'll never forget it in this world or the next. He seemed calmer and fell asleep with my hand on his. His last word was a thank you that cut me like a knife. When I went into his room next morning, he was gone. But on his pillow a letter lay, painfully scrawled in pencil and addressed to me. You lied. Perhaps you meant kindly. You didn't understand. She is not dead. She's been with me again. Though her soul may not leave her body, thank God it can still speak to mine. That vault, it is worse than a mere churchyard grave. Goodbye. I ran all the way to the church and entered by the open door. The air was chill and dank after the crisp October sunlight. The stone that closed the vault of the Hursts of Hurstcote had been raised and was lying beside the dark, gaping hole in the chancel floor. The nurse who had followed me came in before I could shake off the horror that held me moveless. We both went down into the vault. Weak, exhausted by illness and sorrow, John Hurst had yet found strength to follow his love to the grave. I tell you, he had crossed that world alone in the grave that you adorn. Alone, he had raised the stone and had gone down to her. He had opened her coffin, and he lay on the floor of the vault with his wife's body in his arms. He had been dead some hours. The brown eyes filled with tears when I told my wife the story. You are quite right, he was mad, she said. Poor things. Poor lovers. But sometimes when I wake in the grey morning, and between waking and sleeping, think of all those things that I must shut out from my sleeping and my waking thoughts, I wonder, was I right, or was he? Was he mad, or was I idiotically incredulous? For, and it is this thing that haunts me, when I found them dead together in the vault, she had been buried 5 weeks, but the body that lay in John Hurst's arms, among the mouldering coffins of the Hursts of Hurstcote, was perfect.
I have to confess, I'm pretty shaken up by all of this.
Listen, listen, my name is Harry Call. Can you hear me? Don't be afraid. I know you don't know who I am, but I know you. There isn't much to say about myself. I was very sick when I was a boy. I was paralyzed in my left arm and my left leg. I couldn't walk for 6 months. One doctor said that I'd probably never walk again. My mother used to lure me into the hot bath. It was therapy. One time the doorbell rang, so I went down to answer it. I started sliding down. I could feel the water. It started coming to my chin and my nose. When I woke up, my body was all greasy from the holy oil she put on my body. I remember being disappointed I survived. When I was five, my father introduced me to a friend of his, and for no reason at all, I hit him right in the stomach with all my strength. He died a year later. He'll kill you if he gets a chance. I'm not afraid of death.
Murder. wonderful and exciting place. And there are a thousand exciting things to do without experimenting with
music of your own.
This is Vicky from People Like Us, and you're listening to Exquisite Corpse on CITR 101.9 Vancouver.
And this is Bleak at Exquisite Corpse Radio on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You're listening to the Halloween mix from myself, the Value Village people. And we've been listening to many, many minutes of this. And coming up soon is Thunderbird Radio Hell at 9 o'clock. Stay tuned for that. This is the Halloween mix from the Value Village people. / Bleak, which is me on Exquisite Corpse, Canada's favorite radio show. Hey, thanks for tuning in last week and the week before when we presented you the interviews with Mark Hosler of Negative Land and Vicky Bennett of People Like Us. That was a good time. Got to meet them the week later at the Copyright Copy Left Festival, which was exciting stuff and very entertaining. So I'd like to thank them for coming into town and talking to me. It was well worth it.
Boys and girls, my name is Alfred Hitchcock, and I'm delighted to find that you believe in ghosts too. After all, they believe in you, so it is only common courtesy and politeness to return the favor. As a matter of fact, I tell them human stories all the time, and they enjoy them immensely. Now, of course, the best way to listen to ghost stories is with the lights out. There is nothing like a dark room to attract ghosts, and you may like to have some of our mutual friends come and listen with you. Are the lights out? Good. Doors closed, blinds drawn? Excellent. Don't worry about the ghosts getting in. They can slither through keyholes and under doors, you know. Now, just be quiet. Hear that slithering? Ah, good. Now that we're all here, we can begin.
There.
Along this lonely, lonely road was this lonely, lonely hill. And on that lonely, lonely hill stood this lonely, lonely house. And inside that lonely, lonely house was this creaking, squeaking stair. At the top of that creaking, squeaking stair was this long, long hallway. And down that long, long hallway was this flapping, clapping trap door. And above that flapping, clapping trap door was this crying, sighing attic. And in that crying, sighing attic was this shadowy, shadowy corner. And in that shadowy, shadowy corner was this big old chest. And inside that big old chest was a thing!
It is now 56 years since I experienced 10 minutes of the most horrible fright, but ever since then, I tremble at unexpected noises and am afraid of the dark. On that fateful day, as I was walking on the street, I met a friend to whom I was deeply attached as a youth. But he seemed to have aged much more than I. His hair was quite white, and he walked with a noticeable stoop. He apparently noticed my surprise, for he told me of the misfortune which shattered his life. He fell madly in love with a young girl and married her. But after only a year, she died suddenly. He was so affected that he left the chateau and never returned. Now he asked me to do a great favor for him. There were some very important papers in his bedroom desk in the old house. So important that he would trust no one but me to go for them. He gave me the key of the room and the key to the desk, both of which were locked on the day he left the house forever. The two packages of letters and roll of papers were to be found in the first drawer on the right of the desk. Since it was less than an hour's ride on horseback, I readily agreed. The weather was glorious. I cantered over the turf, listening to the birds. I entered the forest and walked my horse. When I reached the house, I was shocked by its condition. The open gate drooped on its hinges. The walks were overgrown with grass. The house itself was badly in need of paint, and the shutters drooped sadly. I finally got the door open and entered. I climbed the creaky old stairs and recognized the door described by my friend. The room was so dark, I could distinguish nothing. My nostrils were offended by the disagreeable, moldy odor. The room was in total disorder. As my eyes became accustomed to the light, I found the writing desk. I opened the proper drawer and began searching for the documents. As I searched, I seemed to hear, or rather feel, something rustle behind me. Then another slight movement sent a disagreeable chill over my skin. As I was about to pick up the third packet, I heard a long, painful sigh just over my shoulder. I leapt up like a madman and turned about. A tall woman dressed in white stood gazing at me. Such a shudder ran through my limbs that I nearly fell backward. Then she spoke. Oh, sir, can you save me, cure me? I suffer frightfully. She held out a tortoiseshell comb and murmured,
Please comb my hair. I suffer because my hair pulls so. I took the comb, then a long black hair. It felt as if I were handling snakes. I don't know how long I combed those icy, slimy locks. Suddenly, she snatched the comb and fled through a closet door. It was as though I had awakened from a horrible nightmare. I burst open a window and sprang to the closet door. It was closed and immovable. I had a mad desire to flee. Seizing the three packets, I dashed from the house, leapt on my horse, and galloped away. When I reached my lodgings, I shut myself into my room to reflect. I had almost convinced myself that I had been the victim of hallucination. Then, by chance, my eyes fell upon my chest. Around the buttons of my jacket were entwined a quantity of long, black, slimy hairs.
slightly from side to side. And look around even further, but keep the rest of your body completely relaxed, completely at ease. No other tensions, but carry on moving your head and your eyes. Notice how it feels to be awesome.
So this is Bleak at Exquisite Corpse Radio on CITR 101.9 Vancouver. Thunderbird Radio Hell is next. Stay tuned. So until next week, remember, the future is bleak. Good night.